There is a grandeur in this view of life with its several powers, having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are still being evolved. And that's just part of my makeup and how I look at the environment and how I get really concerned when I see a species that is being lost possibly because of human activities. So that's just kind of where I've gone, where I am now. I'm working for the state of Minnesota. I'm working on biological indicators of water pollution, and more specifically on wetlands and also on streams, using the critters in the wetlands and the critters in the streams to tell you how healthy that water is. And we can really pick up pollution if we look at the biota, or the biology actually is good information for us, and almost better than measuring a chemical in the water. So that's kind of where I am now, and where I probably will be till I retire. What I'd like to do first off, before I get into giving you background on the frog problem, is just try to hear from you what some of your experiences have been with frogs. Or have you heard them? Have you seen them? Do you have recollections, particularly some of the older people, recollections of frogs in your childhood or sometime in your past? If you could just share a few stories. Yeah?
I've got one. I was a young teacher. I take my classes on field trips. I took them one day to a swamp. And in that swamp, it was a whole bunch of frogs. And there was a great big bullfrog that just blew up his, and sang. But they were all singing to us. It was quite dramatic. That's my frogs.
Anybody else? Yeah?
When I was, younger, my next-door neighbor, he used to catch frogs because we used to live right next. There's a pond right in our backyard. And one day, my sister really wanted to hold that frog. And he had put it in a bucket. And, she accidentally let go. And so the frog went kind of hopping away, and he was kind of mad.
Anyone remember him?
In rural West Virginia. We lived there for a number of years. The first indication of spring, that spring was coming, was the peepers, and that these incredible tiny little frogs would make this. You couldn't hear yourself over the noise that they would make around the pond, and it was really exciting. You'd call each other up and say, "I heard peepers."
Have you been back there to that area?
Well, this was 10 years ago when we were there.
Okay, so
and they were still peeping.
I used to have a pond in my backyard and where a pool used to be, and we took it out and filled it up with water, and tadpoles came and we would watch them grow. And I think for 3 years, frogs just kept on coming and laying their eggs and they'd grow.
Cool.
So now we have a whole bunch in our backyard.
Yeah.
We live in the San Juans, and we have frogs that really, they're the first sign of spring in February. Mm-hmm. They really sing at night. It's just marvelous. And we had, I don't know if they're the same, the little green frogs, mm-hmm. they're the same that peep, but anyway, they're quite numerous, and they, especially when it rains, and they'll even come up on your window. They just mm-hmm. hang on, And
little tree frogs.
They're the tree frogs. Yeah. They're green, and they're still quite. We saw quite a few of these.
Good. Anybody else? I've had some people. Yeah.
Oh, good. I have a frog. It's a water frog as a pet, and it sort of sits in a fish bowl and it just swims around in the water. And what I really like about it most is that it stings, and just like the purring sound is very mm-hmm. soothing.
We have a frog and toad call survey program in Minnesota that people volunteer to do, and I was part of it 1 year. I got too ambitious and tried to do too many places, but it really, to me, was a holy experience to be out in these wetlands in April in Minnesota, not February, and to hear those first frogs calling. And as part of that call survey, you have to go preferably at night and after dusk, and you have to stand there for 5 or 10 minutes. And so you have to stand there quietly, and you have to listen to everything. You have to identify the species. We're all given a tape of the calls. And then you make an assessment of whether it's very intense or sort of intense or just, you know, one here and there. And you rate that. And people are committed to doing this over a long term to actually document the frogs in their area. And to me, it's always, as I say, to me, it's almost like the voices of God to hear the frogs calling in the spring like that. Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about the life cycle of the frog, just if we could pull out what we know about that or what we can elaborate, and then we'll go back and look at that in relation to maybe how pollution could affect frogs or how other disturbance might affect them. Where do the frogs mate and lay their eggs pretty much, at least our north temperate ones?
In ponds.
In ponds? Yeah, anybody know what kind of ponds?
Stagnant water.
They're what?
Stagnant water.
They're stagnant.
Murky. Yeah.
They're what?
Murky ones. Yeah.
Murky. Well, they could be murky, yeah. Do you have fish in those kinds of ponds?
Probably not.
Casual. We have two beaver ponds on some of our property, and they're in there, and there's trout in there. In Washington, state of Washington.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, we have the otter come up, the river otter, and they eat the polywogs in our pond. So there are other ponds that they sing in.
Right.
But I know that they have wiped them out in our pond.
Okay. Do you want to prop that door open? Because I think we will probably overheat the room. Okay, so they're in Minnesota. That's the kind of place. I mean, they reproduce, and depending on the kind of frog, in even these very temporary wetlands that just had water for maybe a couple of months. So they're in a very shallow place. If I can make a picture of this. Okay, so there's not even that much water, but let's put it in there. Okay, then what happens? They lay the eggs. The eggs are fertilized externally by the male, and then what happens?
Polywogs are hatched.
Yeah. Well, they're gelatinous mass.
Yeah, they have this that swells up into this gelatinous mass.
Tadpole. The polywogs.
You get the polywogs.
Yes.
Okay. And anybody know what they eat on? Yeah, they're what we call herbivores. That is, they don't eat animal material. So they have this funny little mouth with kind of little brushes on it, and they browse around over the vegetation or even over the bottom of the pond and eat algae and decomposing vegetation. Then what happens to the frog, to the polywog?
Grows legs.
Loses its tail.
Yeah. Anybody ever watched that? Have you ever seen them? Which, yeah.
In a zoo lab.
In a zoo lab.
Yeah.
Have you seen them out in a real pond?
Yeah.
Which legs do you see first?
The hind legs.
You see that they pop out the hind legs first, and then they pop out the front legs after the hind legs. Are out. So you'll see a tadpole with little tiny legs swimming around. Okay, does anybody know what drives that change from the tadpole to the frog? It's a big change because they're going to. Do you know how the tadpole gets its oxygen or its air?
Gills.
Yeah. Yeah, they have gills, and actually their skin is not very, what we say, permeable. They just have gills that the water, they're kind of hidden. The water passes over. So they do get their oxygen that way. They can gulp, though. They can gulp air, too. Okay, so then the anybody have an idea what drives that change from tadpole to little frog?
Sunlight.
Well, that's important. It's true in the sense that it drives the food. Yeah, they need to have a good temperature. It'll be slower.
Oxygen. Water, the loss of water. When the ponds start dry, they somehow know instinctively ponds are going to dry.
They usually do. They don't.
But I mean, you know, they evolved into that process.
I think that's a longer-term evolutionary thing, that the frogs with a shorter reproduction cycle have tended to go to the more temporary, so they have a quicker development time. So there's an adaptation there. There are some frogs that need to be in a permanent water body and others that have to go to these, like the wood frog has to go to these temporary wetlands.
With food supply?
Food supply probably would do it, slow it. If there wasn't adequate food, it would slow it down. And you probably wouldn't know this, but thyroid hormone is key to driving this change from a tadpole to a frog. And that's just something we put in our minds when we're trying to think of how could the chemistry of the environment maybe muck up their development. Okay, once they get out of the pond, what do they feed on?
Insects.
We've seen all kinds of stuff in it, but they do like bugs. Yeah, crickets, grasshoppers. They love grasshoppers.
Don't they eat a lot of mosquitoes?
They what?
Don't they eat a lot of mosquitoes too?
They would if they're kind of hovering close to the grass. They tend to go out into shallow grassy areas. I'm talking mostly about the leopard frog here. We can't talk about all of them. But they'll go out into these shallow grassy areas and feed on the bugs that are in those. They will pick up worms sometimes too. Okay, anybody know where they go to spend the winter? That's what I thought. The last couple of years has been a quick lesson on frogs. They don't hibernate, and they don't, the leopard frog, they don't go in the mud. I thought they go on it, but they don't go in it. So they, like in Minnesota, they will go to a deeper water body. So if you have this little tiny wetland, you know, then there's, I'll exaggerate it, either a river or a lake. And they'll go down and just lie around on the bottom. We found some in the winter through cutting through the ice and looking at sea fairies at the edge of a pond by the Minnesota River. And they would move. They were moving slowly in this water that was ice cold. I mean, it was just almost frozen water.
So they're still using the gills then?
Well, by now we're transformed. Yeah, we should talk about what happens when you go from a tadpole to a frog. It's this miraculous change from being a gill breather primarily to being a lung breather. So now they're plus a skin breather. The adult frog skin now becomes very porous. And the reason, and they have to keep it moist because they will pick up the oxygen from the air through their skin as well as being able to breathe through lungs. So there's been a change now for the adult frog in being more vulnerable to anything that might go through the skin, whereas the tadpole is more resistant because its skin is pretty tough and tight, but it's got the gills with the water.
But can they live underwater all winter then?
Yeah. And they have to go. But they're still sort of metabolizing, so they have to go to a place that has oxygen. They have to go to a good water. So it'll be like a stream. I didn't know all this. I mean, it's crazy. One of the biologists describes the Minnesota River as just being paved on the bottom with frogs. There used to be massive numbers of frogs in there.
Must have a low metabolic rate.
Goes way down. Yeah.
Well, all these frogs the children find in our window wells, we've got no body of water real close to us.
Do you know what kind of frog that is?
Well, they're big ones.
Okay, it's going to depend on the species because the leopard frogs go to the bigger water and they might migrate a half a mile. The wood frogs and the tree frogs winter on the landscape. So you will also have, it's nicer to have woods and shrubs and things. This is a great drawing here, but anyway. So underneath the litter, you know, the debris, the frogs, the wood frogs and the tree frogs, they actually make their own antifreeze. So they're able to actually let their body temperature, I mean, for Minnesota, it's real important because getting under litter in Minnesota is not going to keep you warm. So they make their own antifreeze, and so they're staying winter up here. They're not going, the leopard frog is going into the deep water, and tree frogs and wood frogs are going into the debris near the wetland. Some of our other frogs stay pretty close to the wetland under debris. And the toad is supposed to overwinter in sandy banks, so it will look until it finds a sandy bank that it can actually burrow into. So all of this tracks in our mind as sort of pollution detectives to try to figure out where might something go wrong. How old are frogs? Or how old can they be? I'm using how old in a loaded way. I want to talk about their own life and then their history.
10 years?
They could. I think the biologists who work with us on this talk about maybe 5 or 6 years for the leopard frogs, and they're finding fewer and fewer of what they call the lunker frogs. You know, they have a certain size break. We measure them all the time. And they're saying it's harder to find the really older frogs, so that the population's becoming kind of younger and younger. Okay, what do the young adult and the adult frogs eat? We said they eat bugs. They're going to eat worms. They're going to be all over the landscape, moving around. They really disperse, finally, away from the wetland. So from that point of view, if you think of the leopard frog being in deeper water or a river, being in temporary or smaller wetlands, spending a lot of time cruising around the landscape, feeding, possibly traveling a half a mile from here to here, and the route from the breed, you know, they come out in the spring and make this migration. And some of the older people have told me about the Minnesota River having frogs that deep on the roads, you know, where they had to bring out bulldozers. You know, people don't see that now, but they saw that 30 years ago. In the fall, I wanted to say one other thing about overwintering too. In the fall, when they go to the site to overwinter, they kind of hang out when they marshal around the place where they're going to spend the winter. And they don't go into that water till it actually gets cold enough. Bob McKinnell, who's worked with us a lot, he's at the university, told me that what you do to tell if they're ready to go into the water is you throw the frog out in the water, and if it does a 180 and comes right back and goes up on the land, the water is still too warm. And they have somehow evolved so that they've got a sense of the temperature when it's cold enough that the fish won't need them. Because once they get into the river, you know, you've got all these bass and all these other guys, anyway, swimming around. And, you know, when fish get colder, you know, and smiling fish, when they get colder, they don't eat as much. So they're not as active chasing the frogs.
Do the frogs, when they're, you know, in the river during winter, how much do they have to eat that much, or do they...
I don't think they're eating. They're not eating at all at that point. So, yeah, so they really have to build up. They have a fat body, two fat bodies, and kind of over their kidneys. They're kind of bright yellow. You can't miss them when you look inside the frog. And they build up. They have to eat a lot of bugs in the fall. So, and they have to do it. They have to build that up to make that migration, because if they do have to trek a half a mile, yeah, they may not be doing as much feeding once they're on the move to the sites. Yeah.
So they can breathe inside the water when they're in the lake?
Yeah, slowly. Through the skin. Mm-hmm. And that's why it has to be good water quality here too. This is why we're so interested in frogs as indicators, because especially the leopard frog, they've got to have good water quality in the overwintering site as well as the breeding pond. Now, what are some things that would come to mind as ways you could lose frogs, or you could just sort of wipe them out?
Contaminant.
Pollution in that water.
Pollution.
Drought. Would drought make a difference?
A drought would make a difference. What would drought do?
Drain the wetland.
Dry up the wetland.
Yeah. Okay. Besides drought, what? Yeah.
You can put barriers between the wetlands and the water.
Yeah, like freeways. Highway 35W.
Yeah.
Tiling will reduce the wetlands.
Yeah, any kind of tiling or draining would do it, and we have a lot of that in Minnesota. There are attempts now to restore wetlands, whether they're in the, you know, these frogs have these long histories of, you know, thousands of years in Minnesota. And, you know, the wetlands are, some of them 5,000, 8,000 years old. And they've got these patterns of migration that, you know, they, but on the other hand, they do find other water, just like what you're saying about the pond. You put, make a backyard pond, they will find it. So what the loss of wetlands is a big one in terms of just losing where they can reproduce, and it kind of forces them to either less desirable places or to have to go further or not to reproduce at all.
How about pesticides, destruction of insects? They're
right.
Feed.
That's a good point. If you're going out into this grassy, they love to be in little alfalfa fields, you know. And you're right, there's got to be abundant insects for them to be able to, within the range that they can move through, for them to be able to get enough food to be able to get through the winter. Okay,
over,
is that, yeah?
Overabundance of predators.
Well, that can happen too. Those happen in cycles. Certainly you've got anybody know what eats frogs?
Crows, maybe.
Crows?
Snakes.
Yeah. Snakes? Yep.
Raccoons,
yeah. Fish? Yeah, fish are bad for the tadpoles. In fact, the trout have wiped out some of the frogs in California because putting trout into areas where they haven't had trout has eliminated historic frog populations. Bullfrogs also, the one biologist I know is angry at the Iowa DNR for moving bullfrogs around because they are carnivores and they eat every other frog and they also drive out all the other frogs. And so you'll have a wetland that has several species of frogs, put in the bullfrogs, and pretty soon they're going to drive everything else out. And they're not native to some of the areas where they've been transplanted.
Why would they put them in there?
I'm not sure.
Why do we do a lot of crazy?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are frogs also affected by the ultraviolet light that is now?
Okay, we'll go into that now when I talk about some of the causes of problems. I'll say that they can be in the future, but right now they aren't, and that's based on a conference I just said. Yeah.
Why would we find a lot of frogs around ponds on a golf course in the desert?
Ah, because there's a water supply. I mean, they are going to find the water, and that brings up the point that some of places like golf course ponds can become what we call an attractive nuisance. I mean, it can, depending on what's in the pond, it can become a place that attracts them for reproduction.
What's in the pond are golf balls.
Well, that's no problem. As long as they didn't use some other things there. Okay, so we can have other thoughts about what would take out frog populations. I wanted to just show you a couple of, this is not much data, I didn't bring anything with me, so which is probably just as well. But I was at a conference in Prague about 3 weeks ago, at International Congress on amphibians and reptiles. And this is just where, you know, and I went to a talk where it's amazing that frogs are being lost very quickly in Costa Rica. We know that some species have been lost there, but the biologists who are actually out there collecting for 24 hours or whatever amount of time, who went last year and they had lots of frogs, and they go this year and they don't find anything, you begin to get scared. And so what I had not been prepared, I thought the amphibian decline was sort of a gradual thing, but it's not. A man from Venezuela was very upset about how they had lost so many species in the 1980s in Venezuela. England, there's a program in Great Britain where they're documenting mortalities. They've got this place for everybody to report frog die-offs, and they've got a map of the country and where they see more than others, and there's a lot of people calling in and saying the frogs are dying off. Biologists, scientists from California talking about the fact that now he had the historic populations of frogs in the mountains in California, and how now he can't find any frogs on the west slopes of the Sierra Nevada. And he drew a little map which had implications of here, the coast of California, whatever it looks like. And still there are frogs up in the mountains on the coastal area. Here's the whole Central Valley. Here's the Sierra Nevada. And on the west slope, there's no frogs. There's still where there had been historic populations. They're still on the east slope. And his theory is that the winds, prevailing winds, come across the Central Valley, which is all agricultural. And he's got a big research project to go after that. He's tried to transplant frogs back into the areas where there had been good habitat and they're not taken. So he's trying to figure out why they can't recolonize the frogs where they had been. So that kind of work, and then this is not, I mean, there are many more states, but for sure I know Minnesota, Wisconsin, Vermont, there are several other states in the country that have reported deformed frogs. 96, and they're coming up again in 97. There's a National Reporting Center in Jamestown that's a federal agency that's collecting reports from all of us in terms of documented findings. So we have two field crews going out, and when we document a county in Minnesota, we let them know. We're not letting them know, at my insistence, the names of the property owners and their phone numbers and the exact location of their property. So we're staying at the county level for this national center, and that's on the website that they have. Many countries, there's a big study going on in Canada, in Ontario, study there where one of the Canadian Wildlife Service biologists is saying that they have more abnormal frogs in ponds that are surrounded by crop, potato or corn crop, than the frogs that they collect in what they call them cultural areas, but that was the French, and I think they really meant non-cropped areas. It could be even pasture areas. I've had connection with people in Denmark and Japan and Italy, and I know there are many other countries that has had some abnormal frogs. One of the Japanese ones is at a former U.S. military site in Japan. And what we've seen in Minnesota last year, these are reports from citizens. We had, it was over 170 reports from people. We documented a number of those, 20 or 25 of those. We didn't have the field crews last year that we had this year. We've had, I don't know, because I have two interns who are doing a great job keeping a database, and every time I get a call, I forward it to them, and they're now on the agency's call-in line so that it goes directly to them, but it's at least 40 or 50 reports. They're going out to confirm them and to meet with people and sample the sites. We have a huge research project going on. I won't be able to tell you the details, but it does involve National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the U.S. Biological Resources Division and EPA, and then the state of Minnesota has made a commitment to doing this. We've seen deformities in seven species. Which one got added? The green frog got added this year. Last year it was the others. These four species, I'll just say their names because I think there's something sacred about the names. These four species are the genus Rana, Ranapipiens, Rana septentrionalis, Rana climatans, and Rana sylvatica, the wood frog. And then they've been seen in the great tree frog, the spring peeper, and the American toad. And the toads are very difficult for people to see because when the little their tadpoles are really small, they're the little black ones, and they metamorphose at about that size. I mean, they're not bigger than my thumbnail. And to look at a little frog like that and see if it's looking normal, you really almost have to take it back to the lab and look at them under microscope. So we've seen them. People on our research team have seen them, and some people have called in to us about deformed frogs, deformed toads. Okay, the kinds of abnormalities Let's see if this works. I didn't bring any slides. If I could even just show you a few slides, it would be much better than telling you in words. A lot of the abnormalities we've been seeing have been in the rear legs. And, you know, once I learned that the rear legs sort of developed first, and I thought, maybe there's something there. We've had everything from simply totally missing a leg to being a little tiny stump of a leg, sometimes mobile, sometimes not, to being part of a leg, to being all the way out. We're keeping very careful documentation of the abnormalities this year, all the way up to just being some problem with the digits. We've also had legs that are, this is the most common here, is number one. We've had legs that are branched. We've had occasional extra legs. In 1995, we had quite a few with extra legs, so a lot of those pictures are kind of out. We aren't seeing as many this year, except in one population. But you do have some with extra legs. The branching could be at any point. I mean, I have one picture where you have like 3 feet, one full foot and then part of another foot, or a branch coming off here, a branch coming off here, or all the way down to the point of being an extra leg branching right out of the base. I'm using my top, but it's really broad. We have seen most of these in front legs too. Only once in a while we've had them missing both legs. And I had somebody just telling me before we came that they saw a frog missing. Is it both front legs? Both front legs. I've seen them missing both rear legs. And how they do that, I did want to ask you when we were talking about feeding, that they have to jump to feed. Mm-hmm. And so how these guys are doing this is just beyond me. I mean, because, they jump and they pitch over. But they have been able to gather food. It's phenomenal.
Snow bugs.
And sometimes, rarely, the leg is misplaced, meaning it might be coming right out of the side somewhere. We've had a number where the leg has been bent. It'll look normal up to a point, and then it bends, and then at that point, usually the skin is not normal. It's not pigmented normally. It's kind of pink, and then it's just sort of a little distorted piece. It doesn't. Once it starts bending, the development is just gone haywire. So that's what that whole category is. And we've had them also where they have almost no muscles. They have this really skinny leg, and they also have some abnormality on the foot or the end. And sometimes the leg is just paralyzed. So it's just sticking straight out and not functional. We've also seen this thing we call web skin. I learned at a meeting that the term is cutaneous fusion, but I really prefer webbed. And that is where the skin is going right across the leg. They can't really extend it. It's got to be a handicap also. And then here, this is just a skin thing where you don't have the pigmentation. We've had them with missing eyes. We usually have one or two in a collection. We try to collect 100 frogs at a time and see the time it's going here. Some with a covered eye, some with a reduced eye. I just had a call from somebody who had a frog with the eyes at the back of the head, which is displaced eyes. The Canadians have had eyes displaced so that they have a picture of an eye on a side. One of the frogs that was reared in Dr. McKennell's lab was missing an eye, and they saw a lump in the throat and looked in, and the eye was actually... So the development just got pushed away from the normal place. Inside Dr. McKennell, and I've seen this, the testes is translucent in these young males. Now, this may be a secondary effect of whatever is just sort of, inhibiting their whole system. And he sees the intestine being very thin walled. He'll be following this up this year to see if this is real. Bone and cartilage don't look right by the people who are doing this at the National Wildlife Health Center lab. And we're also seeing the tadpole tails not resorb. And some of them, we don't know if that's an abnormality or if that might indicate some kind of chemical effect. Potential causes. Ultraviolet light, or UVB, which is the most damaging one, was pretty much at the frog meeting was by a biologist who's doing some very careful studies, was shown not to be a factor. Now, there are some species that may be sensitive to ultraviolet light, in the future. But as she showed, for instance, salamanders lay their eggs very deep in the water. And if you put those eggs up and expose them to ultraviolet light, they are sensitive and they would be damaged. But they have adapted their system to lay the eggs deeply. The frogs that lay their eggs right up near the surface are very resistant to ultraviolet light. So they've had this long kind of evolutionary adaptation that they can actually break down the damage that ultraviolet does. So her feeling right now is there's only a couple of species that may be vulnerable in the future if it increases. And this is based on looking at ultraviolet records in the environment and in relation to where the frogs are laying their eggs. We're looking at potential cause of parasites. There's one biologist who's pushing very strongly to the idea that parasite cysts laid at the base of the developing limb block the proper signaling that goes to the little limb bud as it's developing and causes these extra legs. And he's campaigning very strongly for this. We don't so far have any evidence in what we're looking at in terms of parasite loads in relation to normal frogs and abnormal frogs. But we're going to look at that even more carefully this year, because what we need to do is lay to rest some of the ideas. Infections aren't seen by the National Wildlife Health Lab. They have that capability, like a hospital, to do diagnostic workup, so they're part of our cooperative team. Genetic change takes a long time to look at. We don't think that this is a change in the genes. We don't think this is heritable. I should say that very, very few of these frogs make it through the winter. So where we're seeing this is in the young of the year, and it's very unusual for us to see a second-year-old, two-year-old frog with a deformity. What we're putting a lot of our effort on are the chemicals, looking at metals, all of these, mercury, arsenic, selenium, and cadmium, and a bunch of others, have been shown to cause abnormalities. We're looking at pesticides, both old ones, DDT products, you know, that are hanging around, and new ones that are out, because the interest in the new ones is, we asked the question, what's different in the last 3 years? We're looking at something that came in and went like this. And our biologists have not seen deformed frogs in the past. And all of a sudden, you know, from 93 on, and especially 95.
Yeah. Are all of these pesticides being used worldwide or in all of these countries that the deformities are being noted in?
Well, this is the why it's useful, going to be useful to have this National Reporting Center, and I hope they're also going to be pulling in other countries, because what we need to do is look across the landscapes. There's going to be a bigger project that does a kind of a landscape analysis to see. Yeah, we're only able to look at Minnesota and ask what do these sites have in common. And getting at that information is very difficult. But we're doing, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences is kicking in a lot of water chemistry money, I mean, a lot. And they're doing a lot of the analysis from a whole set of sites that we're looking at intensively. We're looking at other organics. I'm just putting question mark, endocrine disruptors. Those are chemicals that mimic natural hormones. We have a question if there's a chemical that mimics thyroid hormone, or is there a chemical that mimics some of these special signals for development? There's a lot of interest in that. There's one mosquito control product that does mimic chemicals that are used, that are normal in limb bud development, and so they can take that product methaprine and cause abnormalities. And we have to think about combinations, maybe, or other factors. There's some evidence that if you put a couple of different pesticides together, or a pesticide and ammonia, or you combine factors, that you suddenly up the ante on the effect that you get. So, in a summary, what we're looking at now in a rather huge project that's involving a lot of different agencies is, I'm just giving a real overview. What we want to do is characterize the abnormalities. The reason is, this is my old zoology stuff, but the actual structural changes will be characteristic of whatever is causing this. I mean, DDT causes a blunt nose in tadpoles. Well, so I have these, you know, our great interns, you know. Then I hear somebody say, well, such and such caused the closing of the nose holes in tadpoles. Have you guys been looking at the nose holes, you know, or a change in the structure of the mouth? Anytime we get information on this particular chemical or environmental agent can cause this kind of abnormality, it's going to help us try to relate what we can characterize both externally and internally. Then we're looking for evidence of parasites and for infections, and then we're looking pretty heavily into the pollution chemistry, both in the water, and this is like through the season, in the mud of these ponds, and in the, we've had to, I would say, sacrificially collect frogs properly to do what we call tissue analysis, to see if we can spot something in the frogs through their life stage that is unusual. And that's hard because a lot of research is not focused on frogs. We've got information with other animals about contaminants in tissues. So there's a lot of interest in getting more information so we can interpret it. I think I'll stop there for questions and let you go if you'd like to go.
Has genetic engineering proceeded far enough so this might be a potential? Or has it been considered as a potential?
For, you mean for explanation? Or?
Yes.
Someone wondered if somebody might be, in one of the seminars I gave in a church actually, if there might be somebody who would have been damaging frogs intentionally and releasing them in the environment. But when you look at the state of Minnesota, this won't be a very good picture, you know, I think you can fit all of New England in it. And you've got deformed frogs, and up in the northeast, or you know, and we've got these locations so far that it would be pretty tricky to think that someone was intentionally damaging frogs.
Well, yeah. Worldwide distribution of the proposition is.
What are these farmers and people just find these frogs? A child finds a frog and
yeah, kids. Them? Kids are the eyes. I mean, the kids. I didn't really say the whole story how it started. It was a group of school kids who were in a charter school, publicly funded charter school called the Minnesota New Country School. And Cindy Ryan, who's just an angel, she's the true frog lady. We're out doing a nature walk, and the kids started seeing these abnormal frogs, and she called me to say, because I had gone after a deformed frog thing 2 years before, and told me about it, and I just sent my guy assistant down there that day because we were tied up, and he just came back and said, you got to go down there. He said, like, you know, a third or more of what I was picking up was abnormal. So the kids, and then, you know, but it's been like farm kids are out or kids are playing in a park and they look at the frogs. It's also been people collecting them for fishing. You know, there's more word out now, so I think people are more conscious. There's a big program through Hamline University, through the schools. Coordinating, and so we get reports now through the frog hotline at Hamline, and they call people back, and we've got our whole reporting system that we use and that they use, and so they funnel reports to me. I'll get a fax of 7 things, give them to our interns who are doing the database. You know, so it's coming in directly from people, as well as.
Do you have a web page?
Yes, we do. And I don't have it with me. I don't have it with the pollution control agency does, and they put like 21 of my slides. The school kids do it too. The Minnesota New Country School has a web page.
You know, when you were showing on the other page there the deformities in the upper legs, I was thinking back when thalidomide was identified.
Yes, that's
and I was thinking from the standpoint of marketing this program to the people like maybe I was playing cards with earlier. They, what about frogs? Who cares about frogs?
Right.
And but they're very concerned about out there on the order of thalidomide that could be affecting them, then they would be very concerned about, and probably would have been here to hear this, if they could put the connection, but a lot of people don't.
That is just the issue. I mean, I'm probably one of the few people who cares about the frogs because they're part of God's creation, and they're, you know, I mean, it's all part of this whole thing to me. But I do hear from people in Minnesota both concerns. I mean, they're concerned about, they want to know if it's safe. I had a call from a woman, was it safe to buy the house? They already had closed the house and they were about to move in, and they found a couple of tree frogs missing an eye and missing a leg. And, you know, it's pretty tough because I had to say, well, first of all, to have the tree frogs, you know, is a great thing. I mean, if people are worried about, and there has been a study in Minnesota of birth defect rates in the children of pesticide applicators being elevated. And so, you know, you put that together with the frog thing, and there is a lot of concern about human health also.
Is there, did you infer when you were pointing out that when the valley there in California where the food crops are raised with the pesticide, herbicide, and the west blow wind, that the inference might be that that west bank or the west side of the mountains are devoid as a consequence of carrying airborne pesticides? I mean,
yeah,
is that
that's
the
what Gary Bellers is saying. You know, there's also, I'm sure, habitat loss there. He's also saying that the putting of the trout in the streams there by California, whatever their DNR is, has taken out a lot of the frogs too. So there's kind of a combination of Natural Resource Management Agency, habitat loss, and he feels the pesticides coming across the Central Valley.
How difficult is it to get high profile awareness of this whole area that you're dealing with? Because I know when we talk about possible pollutants in our drinking water, everybody flocks off to buy water from this source or that source, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they're concerned. And how, except for being here and hearing you and having seen a couple of accounts in the paper, I've not seen or heard anything about this.
Yeah, it's pretty big in Minnesota. We have pretty regular press coverage. We've been on, public McNeil Laird, our Almanac program, and a lot. There's been a lot of media coverage. We're on Nightline again, I think, next week. They did a piece already. I don't know that I'll be on it that much because Dorothy was really out in the field with everybody. But they did a pretty good coverage of the basic issues of the frog problem, except giving up too much identification maybe to ultraviolet, but it is a concern that everybody has. Mm-hmm. I think there was one big concern.
Has the government been involved in giving you any grants or anything like that?
Well, that's a story, but anyway, the state of Minnesota did, our agency came up with some funding, and we went through the governor's initiative, which is the normal process, and got funding for the field crews and a coordinator of field crews that we have now. What NIEHS is contributing there in North Carolina, their International Institute of Health, is probably, I don't know, probably a couple $100,000. I would say, on this chemistry. I mean, they're doing, it may be more, but it's a big contribution. And then they're funding the National Wildlife Health Lab to do the diagnostic workup. And then EPA did some kind of freebies. But NIEHS is really our main partner in terms of really making a big contribution. Then I got the idea we ought to do, there's a test to do on water where you put developing frog eggs in water and you look for abnormalities. It's a standard test to screen things for human concern called the Phetax acid. And we have one very bad site where 75% to 80% of the frogs, of two of the mink frog and the green frog, are grotesquely abnormal, and they were dying in the shallow water area. It was awful. It was really awful. And I took water up to the EPA lab, and they tested it for what we call acute toxicity, where you expose small animals. And it did kill one kind of animal in 40 hours, and that was significant. But the other water went to a lab in Oklahoma that does this assay for frog embryos, and they saw some abnormalities in the short term. And so now they're running a longer-term assay to get it out to the limb development stage. And if we have abnormal limbs in those frogs, I'll tell you, we've made a big step up, because if the water in that site still has something in it that causes deformities, maybe we can figure it out, you know. That's, I mean, I'm really excited. I want to know what's going on in that acid.
Wait, I think you have your hand in here.
Have deformed frogs been found up in the bone?
Yeah, oh, well, they're up in northeastern Minnesota. We have a few locations here. And I'm not sure if you and I have been able to document those yet. But those are going to be very important, because if they have no forestry practice or agriculture practice or human activity around them, we're going to have to look at air deposition. We have mercury in some northern Minnesota lake, the fish, and I don't know if you're aware of fish consumption advisories, and we have mercury in fish at levels where they suggest people, particularly pregnant women, don't eat many of the fish from this particular lake and that particular lake. Well, these are in areas with no, you know, they don't have a coal burning power plant right near them, but it's coming over probably from Canada and deposits in Minnesota. So yeah, I mean, to me that area is very important that we look at the non-agricultural area of the state. Yeah.
That's what I was going to get at. These states I noticed where they have these deformities, it seems to be areas that have high measurements for acid rain from fossil fuel driven plants. I don't know if there's any correlation between acid rain and these areas.
Yeah, yeah, that would be true, but we'd expect even more in northeastern Minnesota. But we had very commoner got involved in this, and he's doing some air quality stuff. And I tried to get the ecologist in North Carolina, who's also a big air person, in. But I think once we get our stuff, our data from this summer, we maybe can pull in a high-powered air quality person. We have them in our agency too. I mean, the mercury problem was really worked up by one of our staff people in air quality, and I'm already trying to get somebody to fund doing collectors in different parts of the state, so we can get you know, atmosphere, rain, snow, you know, what's it bringing down. If it were in an acid rain situation, it also would mobilize some of the metals too. So that would be another thing that comes in with coal burning power plants is the metals, and you know, so we would look very carefully at these for being elevated, because they can cause abnormality too, so it's not necessarily pesticides. Did that answer what you...
Yeah. How much has Japan been involved in this? Have you any idea? Because if you were to consider nuclear radiation, you might expect high levels of deformities there, and perhaps in Russia and the north western areas that the Chernobyl.
This is interesting. At the Prague meeting, well, I tried to talk to these Japanese guys, and they couldn't speak English. I mean, literally. So he opened up the Japanese journals and pointed to somebody's article. But I already had received something from a Japanese person about deformed frogs in Japan. But the guy was telling me about here was the ammunition storage area in Japan that was Japan's. Another one was a former U.S. military site. And you know that the former military sites have cost, closing down the military sites has not been as big a saving, because they are environmental hazard areas and have to be cleaned up.
Clean up.
Yeah.
It's not the worst.
But when I talked to a guy from Moscow, I said, well, have you got deformed, because I'd heard there were deformed frogs in Russia, but I hadn't talked to anybody. So have you got deformed frogs in your area, I guess I said. I didn't quite know how to call the country. No. Well, we get talking to them a lot. And then he says, well, you know, we do have them in our radioactive contaminated areas. And so-and-so has been looking at them up in northern, you know, north of Moscow. So. I got concerned about that and called up the Minnesota Department of Health to find out where our radioactive fallout monitoring station or stations would be in the state, and we don't have any. So we don't monitor. I wanted to see what the trends were in the last 5 years. We don't even monitor it.